I'm Christopher Lydon, and this is The Connection. This turn of the century is another Mao moment. It's an occasion in China and in the West for reevaluating one of the outside characters of our time and maybe of all history. The peasant revolutionary, warrior, poet, military strategist, political theorist, natural-born leader who forced the transformation of the most populous nation in the world into a communist state of peculiarly Maoist dimensions. He was a man of relentless energy and a ruthless self-confidence who became, as Jonathan Spence writes, one of the toughest and strangest in China's long tradition of formidable rulers who wield extraordinary powers neither wisely nor well, and yet were able to silence effective criticism for years or even decades by the force of their own character and the strength of their acolytes and guards. Mao's life was played out on a grander canvas than the other giants of the 20th century, Churchill, Roosevelt, and De Gaulle, as our guest Philip Short observes in his new Big Mao biography. Stalin had the Russian Revolution and the shoulders of Lenin to stand on, but Mao began at the beginning, at a moment when he thought China was threatened by colonial dismemberment. The toll of his victims by the end may have exceeded the carnage of those other modern monsters, too. We're talking about the dominant figure in the Middle Kingdom in what is still embattled near hindsight this hour with the London Times and BBC reporter who's written an exhaustive book on Mao, Philip Short. Connection listeners, do we have a headline on our memories of Mao, the military figure, the ultimate cultural commissar, a modernizer? Or was he a monster of Hitlerian, Stalinesque proportions? 1-800-423-8255 joins the conversation on Mao with Philip Short, or 1-800-423-TALK. Philip Short, give us your sort of framing perspective on this man.
Johnny, difficult to do in a phrase or a word. Mao was so much larger than life in that he compressed into his being not only so many different characters. I mean, you've mentioned them: poet, visionary. I mean, I think visionary is one of the absolutely key words for Mao. Military strategist and all the rest. He lived a whole load of different lives simultaneously, in a way, but also he did it on such an extraordinary scale. When he was born and grew up, China was still mired in a medieval system, which had not really changed for 1,500 years, nearly 2,000 years. By the time he went, China was a great power with nuclear weapons, satellites, intercontinental missiles, all the rest. He compressed into one lifetime changes which took other countries, other sets of leaders, centuries to accomplish. Mm. So it's very difficult to pick out, you know, one word or one phrase. A monster? No, I don't go for that. A tyrant? Certainly, but saying Mao was a tyrant is just about like saying, you know, he was a human being. It was one of the givens that he was a tyrant, but he was an awful lot more than that as well, which I hope we'll explore in the next hour or so.
Yeah, let's do it. You say he was not a monster. You also credit him in a fashion with centuries of modernization in one tumultuous lifetime. I wonder, I mean, let's... Can I ask you bluntly, do you feel yourself part of a kind of rehabilitation effort here around Mao?
No, I don't. And it's interesting to me that you put that question, because our views of Mao have changed, you know, so radically over the years. If you go back to the 1960s, certainly in Europe, I mean, lots of radicals, and I think in the States as well, lots of people thought, gosh, this is a leader who's really trying to do something new. The Cultural Revolution was not well understood outside China at the time. People thought, he is trying to bring a new revolutionary system into being. And there were a lot of people who thought, well, you know, good for Mao. He may be breaking a lot of eggs, but he's going to make a rather nicer omelette than we've seen before. Then people realized, actually, that the Cultural Revolution was disastrous, and you went through a period when Mao was very much discredited. And after that, I think you've had attempts to find a more balanced view. I don't regard rehabilitation in any sense as being desirable for Mao. I think what I've tried to do in the book, and what I think is important, is to understand why he was as he was, why he behaved. Because you look at China now, and you need to know where China has come from. And to a very large extent, it has come from Mao. And you can only really understand, I think, the things which are going on in China now, the democratization that is taking place, the greater freedoms. We just heard you can't have semi-nude women on billboards anymore. Well, okay, that's the kind of bureaucratic nonsense they have. But at least there's a debate about having semi-nude women on billboards. You know, that is a huge step forward compared with what there was in Mao's time. And what happened in Mao's time was again an enormous step forward by comparison with the feudal regime which existed before.
The force of his character on so large a population makes it almost impossible to locate a human personality inside, you know, these megalomaniac ideas like the Great Leap Forward or the Cultural Revolution or the sort of ideological manifestos at various times in his life. But I wish you'd try to go back to, you know, Hunan province at the end of the last century and set the beginning of this personality. Can you do that?
Well, yeah, I will try indeed, because I think despite the, you know, all the ideological jargon and these phrases, these terms, Cultural Revolution and Great Leap Forward and so on, which kind of obscure our understanding.
No, no, yeah, and we've got to come to this that, you know, I think we all distrust the poetry, but also these doctrinaire ideological evolutions and arguments and intense sort of communist debate that he grew up in. It's hard. We have to figure out sort of what that means in human terms.
Right. Well, he wasn't a communist to start with. I mean, remember, he was born in 1893, and he in a very small village outside Changsha in Hunan province, which is in the sort of center of China. And he had an absolutely classical Chinese education. He learnt, first of all, learnt the characters, then he learnt by heart great chunks of the Confucian classics, and by the time he was about 10, he could read for himself, but he had no idea about anything outside China, or indeed very much outside Hunan. So he had the same sort of education as a Chinese boy, a relatively privileged Chinese boy, because his father was a farmer and was reasonably well off, would have had 500 years earlier in the Ming Dynasty, or 500 years still earlier in the Tang. It wasn't very different from what had always been in China. Communism came much, much later. When the emperor fell with the revolution in 1911, Mao was already 18. Still no word of communism. But the revolution, the fall of the emperor, the coming of a warlord system, smashed down barriers and opened doors, and ideas, ferment of ideas, came in from foreign countries, from the West, from Europe, from America. People like Darwin, Bertrand Russell, John Dewey, the American educationalist, they became known in China. People began talking about their ideas. And part of this ferment was anarchism. Mao was first drawn to anarchism. And it was only very reluctantly, when he realized that kind of wishy-washy notions of you know, new people's communes with no government and no laws and no state, that this really wouldn't work in practice. Only very reluctantly did he turn to communism after the Bolshevik Revolution in 1917. And he turned to communism because, like most young men of his generation, young women too, in China, he believed that China was in danger of being broken up by the imperialist powers, by Japan, the United States, Britain, Germany, mm-hmm. and that unless something drastic was done to restore confidence to the country, to make the country great again, it would virtually cease to exist. And to Mao, communism was the only possible tool that might do that.
Is that what all the ideological inquiry of the late teens, early 20s boils down to? Save one China?
In the end, yes. He was a nationalist, a very patriotic, idealistic young man who, you know, had one met Mao at that time, you would have thought, well, you know, what an interesting, progressive-minded, decent, loyal man. He was very, very much committed to China's salvation. It's a big word to use, but that was how they all saw it. And I say a decent, loyal man, a decent man, but in the context of a society which was still very barbaric and very medieval in its ways, where people would be tortured to death in front of magistrates in the most appalling fashion if they were suspected of thieving or of some other crime, where riots would be suppressed and the heads of the ringleaders or the suspected ringleaders would be erected on pikes and put on the town walls, where criminals would be killed, again on magistrates' orders, by a process of slow strangulation that lasted about 24 hours. In other words, it was a country where there wasn't a great deal of gentleness and compassion, and that is part of the essential background, because when you look at the brutality of so much that Mao did and the communists did, it comes from the way that they were brought up and the context in which they were brought up, which was extraordinarily brutal.
The long march in the mid-30s and then the beginning of a kind of personality cult around Mao in the 40s seems to have transformed that decent, loyal, maybe idealistic man. Explain it.
Very slow transformation, but it certainly did. I mean, I think the absolutely key episode was in 1930-31, and it's one which has been more or less ignored in China and almost totally ignored in the West as well. The so-called Futian events. I mean, basically, what happened was that slowly... The communists in the 1920s began to realize that they would have to fight with arms if they were ever going to win. To start with, they didn't want to use arms. They thought that the force of their ideas would conquer all. But they became more realistic. They took up arms. As the struggle became bloodier and people were killed in battle, the fear of counter-revolution, of counter-revolutionaries, in other words, of traitors, became greater. And it all boiled up in 1930 in these so-called Futian events, which were basically, it was the first major purge within the Chinese Communist Party, and it was launched by Mao in a situation when the communists were under tremendous pressure from their nationalist rivals, tremendous military pressure, their survival was at stake. And what did they do? They turned inward and basically imploded. 4,000 or 5,000 were killed initially, mainly in the army, and then the thing spread outwards. And anything, I mean, it almost sounds like Pol Pot's Cambodia. If you wore glasses, you were liable to be killed. If you did anything suspect, you were liable to be killed as a traitor. And that was the beginning of the what later became called the merciless struggle and hard blows. In other words, the party purging itself, differences within the party and between the party and its enemies being resolved in an extremely harsh and cruel fashion. And although later, there were reactions. I mean, Mao tried to find other ways of solving inner party differences and ideological disputes. There was always this use of terror in the background, and it was an essential part of his rule. But again, I would say, look where they came from. You know, they came from a country in which terror was used by the imperial authorities, and had always been a part of Chinese life. The communists made it worse, but they didn't get it from nowhere.
But you know, you expect a certain, in a revolutionary who, as you said, is above all a visionary, you expect a kind of a reflection, or you expect more. What was it that sort of prevented me? Go ahead.
You say you expect more. Yes, but from what standpoint? You know, no one else has tried has been confronted with the task of bringing such a huge and disparate country with such an enormous population forward so quickly. You know, if one looks at the tasks of an American president or of a, let alone a European prime minister, and you look at the Chinese leadership now, again, they have different problems, but they have problems on a scale which most other leaders, thank goodness, do not have to cope with. And that should not be used to justify. And the last thing I want to do is to apologize for Mao. He knew very well what he was doing. He was utterly ruthless in what he did. But I'm not sure that it would have been possible without very extreme methods to bring about the degree of change that he brought about in the time that he did it. Now, whether, you know, one can argue, well, should he have, shouldn't he have, but that's highly speculative. But
well, it's late in the game, of course, to be arguing about should he or shouldn't he have, but it's immensely important in terms of our judgment of these people. The phone is 1-800-423-8255 or 1-800-423-TALK. We're talking about the late Chairman Mao with his new biographer, Philip Short. 1-800-423-TALK is our phone. Richard is on the line.
Hi, Chris. I'd just like to say that Mao's negative press in the United States has been extensive over the years. I think it was only because he chose to raise the red flag rather than something other than closer to the stars and bars. He had the nerve. He had the absolute nerve to call the United States a paper tiger. He had the absolute nerve to defy the United States on a lot of foreign policy issues. And our obsession, coming not only out of McCarthyism and the Red Scare back in the 30s, our obsession with fighting communism is what was the prime engine driving this negative press for Mao.
Richard, that sounds extremely simplistic to me,
unreconstructedly
50s, 60s Maoist.
I'm sorry, Chris. If Chiang Kai-shek got up on top of Tiananmen in 1949 and said, "We defeated the communists, we've stood up," this would be a whole different argument. You have to allow the complexity, just like the author has been saying. You have to allow Mao some complexity. And remember, too, that he didn't...
Well, let's allow a little complexity and say, the story is not defined by his defiance of the United States.
He didn't run the entire show by himself. You're going to leave out Lin Biao? You're going to leave out Zhou Enlai?
What is that? Are we talking about his bad press in the United States as being the center of the story, or his bad accomplices? I mean, give me your own stake in Mao.
My own stake in Mao is that he is a positive force in history, and that under very complex situations, very complex situation and background, he transformed a very poor country that couldn't even manufacture matches at one time into a power to be reckoned with. And that's okay. Things that happen along the way, well, what do you think civil wars do? Civil wars wind up killing people. Look at our own. He has a right to a civil war.
You have a very generous view of it. Richard, I mean, have you been there?
Yeah, I was there. I got there before Richard Nixon. Okay, and at the time, at 1971, you had the Lin Biao incident in which the defense minister was up to something. Nobody would discuss it. You could tell that there was something palpable in the air, and people wouldn't talk about certain things. That's okay. That's for me to study. They wouldn't talk to us because they didn't know who we were. And I understand that. That's okay. So what I find good about these biographies, the good ones and the bad ones, I haven't read Mr. Short's book, so I'm not going to pass judgment. I just discovered it, is that more and more information come out about Mao so we can have a more equal balance.
Richard, thank you. 1-800-423-8255. Jim is on a car phone. Hello, Jim. Try it again, Jim. 1-800-423-8255. Hillary is on the line.
Yes.
Welcome.
Thanks for taking my call. I had just been actually watching the movie Gandhi the other night and thinking that, hearing you talking today, I've been thinking that there is another way to transform society other than with the extreme measures espoused and did that passive resistance has really changed society a whole lot in the 20th century. Gandhi, Martin Luther King, people like that have affected huge changes without the violence.
Philip Short.
I think that's a very interesting point, but you've got to remember, you know, who was Gandhi struggling against? He was struggling against the British, who, for all their faults, are reasonably civilized. Which country was Martin Luther King, struggling in? The United States, again, a democracy. Mao was operating in totally different circumstances. There was a civil war, which there certainly wasn't in India, in which huge armies were mustered on both sides. You know, you had armies in the late 40s when the Chinese Civil War came to an end with 1.5 million men on either side. I mean, these are the greatest land battles that have ever actually been fought anywhere with these numbers of men being maneuvered. This was war on a huge scale. And I don't think nonviolence or passive resistance, I mean, you're transplanting something into a context where it would not work.
Philip Short, let's talk about, not about the war, but the consolidation after 1949, and very specifically about the Cultural Revolution. This is what comes up among Chinese people today. In China, I'm sure, but certainly among hundreds of thousands of Chinese in our world, how do you account for this? Describe it first and then explain what in the world he was up to.
I think there are two ways in which people see the Cultural Revolution. The sort of orthodox view in the West has been that Mao felt in the 1960s he was losing power and that he was being elbowed aside by the people he had chosen as his successors. Therefore, he launched the Cultural Revolution against them. I think that is much too simple. I prefer to look at it in terms of ideas, that Mao became concerned as he became an old man, he was in his 70s, that when he died, his ideas were going to die with him. He didn't trust the people he had put in to succeed him to carry on his ideas of permanent revolution, trying to build a kind of rural utopia of equality, fraternity, all these wonderful words which are always honored in the breach. So he launched the Cultural Revolution in order to try to radicalize China, to make China a red beacon, if you like, a revolutionary beacon which would shine out to the rest of the world. And the way to do that was to make people struggle, because if there has been one constant in Mao's life since he was a young man, it has been struggle, constant battling, disharmony, chaos, call it what you will, but the Cultural Revolution was an attempt to create a red utopia by making its people, by radicalizing the minds of the Chinese people. And it was a stultifying disaster, because the Red Guards, the young men and women, the young students who flocked to the Maoist cause in the Cultural Revolution, very quickly descended into violence of extraordinarily barbaric kinds. I mean, they beat each other to death, they blew up their teachers, they ransacked people's homes, they smashed anything that was regarded as bourgeois or old, and basically it was an exercise in destruction with nothing new being built at the end. And in the end, Mao recognized this, and the army had to be brought in to calm it down. That's what it was, but it was the beginning of the last act, if you like, the tragedy of Mao's last years, when he began.
But if I ask, and I don't mean to, you know, make you an apologist, but how do the people who figure Mao as a constructive force in history embrace this?
Well, he wasn't. He was a destructive force. He simply wasn't constructive. He was very good at destroying, but he was hopeless at building. To me, the jury is still out, and I'm not dodging a judgment. I think Mao was undoubtedly an extraordinarily great man because of what he did, of what he accomplished. He made China stand up. If you ask Chinese today, what do you, and I'm talking about people on them in the mainland, in Beijing and in other cities, what do you think of Mao? They will usually say he was a great man.
Hold that big thought right there. We're going to take a short break. We're talking about Mao with his biographer, Philip Short. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston and PRI. Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation, empowering people with innovative internet technology and offering dynamic career opportunities at Allaire.com. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection. Our guest is Philip Short, who has compressed into a mere 750 pages or so the life of, in great man terms, the greatest of the great men slash monsters of the 20th century, Mao Zedong. Philip Short writes, he was unquestioned leader of almost a quarter of mankind, inhabiting an area the size of Europe. He wielded powers equaled only by the most awesome of Chinese emperors in an era when China's history was so compressed that changes which in the West had taken centuries to accomplish occurred in a single generation. In Mao's lifetime, China made the leap from semi-colony to great power, from despoiled victim of imperialist plunder to permanent member of the UN Security Council, complete with H-bombs, surveillance satellites, and ICBMs. 1-800-423-8255 makes the Mao connection with the British journalist Philip Short. I interrupted you at the point of your defining his peculiar greatness.
Well, in terms of the Chinese view, if you ask Chinese today what they think of Mao, they usually will say, yes, of course, he was a great man. Why? Because he made China stand up after this century of humiliation, starting from the Opium War and continuing through the dividing up of China into spheres of influence, the treaty port system where foreigners applied their own laws and Chinese were really second-class citizens, all of this. He brought, reunified China, he ended the war, and he made China stand up. He gave the country back its pride. That is what Chinese value Mao for. And you may say, well, what about the Cultural Revolution? You know, surely people suffered so much they hate him. Well, I can only talk about my own family. My wife is Chinese, and she is one of 10 children. My first brother-in-law was sent down to the countryside as a young student. Education ruined. He stayed there for the next 25 years. Basically, his life was shattered. Second brother, as a 16-year-old, complained during the Great Leap Forward, complained to school friends that he was hungry. He was arrested, put into prison, tried to escape, and spent 25 years in the Chinese prison system. Mm. Fourth brother was executed as a counter-revolutionary in 1975, just before Mao died. Another brother lost a leg during the Cultural Revolution. Okay, that's out of 10. Almost every intellectual family in China could tell you similar stories. And yet most of them, and I haven't talked to most of them, but the people I do talk to will say, yes, he did achieve something. He did give us back our pride. And that is hugely important. It's on that nationalist level that people today still look on Mao as having been a positive force. In just about every other way, his rule, once he achieved power, was disastrous. But in another sense, and I don't want to sound like an apologist here either, he did destroy an awful lot of the old feudal system and of old Chinese ways of behavior. And I do think you can make a case for saying that the quite extraordinary growth of China now, economic growth, the way the country is opening up and embracing foreign ideas at every level, and it is happening so fast. I go back every year, and every time I go back, I am shattered by the changes that have happened. It really is happening a lot faster than most people in the West, in America, understand.
You can, but what is the Mao handing out, or is it a flight, a headlong flight from Mao?
Well, you can say it's a headlong flight from Mao, but I don't think that's necessarily quite the way to look at it. I think you can look at it as a very destructive period when, the playing field was cleared of a lot of old ways of thought, which were not, in China in the past, the greatest good was in stability. The country stagnated, and anybody regarded any kind of innovation as dangerous. Mao did rid China of those ideas, and I think you can say maybe that he cleared the ground for the men who are now in power, Deng Xiaoping after his death, and then the present generation of leaders, to really forge ahead in economic development and in all these other ways. I mean, it's not a case, I raise it as a possibility. I'm not arguing it necessarily, but I think there may well be a connection. If you look back in Chinese history, there have been previous periods of immense disruption. Very short-lived. In 2,000 years ago, the Qin Shi Huangdi, the Emperor of Qin, really turned the country upside down. And his dynasty lasted only about 20 years. It was followed by a golden age, which lasted 400 years, the Han. Same thing after the Sui in the 6th century. It was followed by a golden age of the Tang. There is a kind of logic to that kind of transition. Now, will there be another golden age? Well, I'm not predicting.
1-800-423-8255. The Mao Zedong connection with the biographer Philip Short. Kathleen is on the line.
Yes, Chris, I'm delighted to be talking with you and Mr. Short. I am not a student of Chinese history, although I do intend to read his book now that I've heard him and heard his insights. I was in Beijing about 16 years ago, and when I was there, I met many people who were PhDs, who were unfortunately had to be relegated as travel agents and tour guides because they couldn't find any work. And one of the impressions that I got from the people there was the enormous, and I can't even describe this in words, sadness that these people had when they could not read a book for 10 years during the Cultural Revolution. And they said to me, how can you in any way appreciate what it would be like for someone who has an intellect of any kind not to be able to read a book for 10 years? And they said, you cannot imagine the suffering that we experienced here. And I think that, you know, if one of the problems that we had in the Mao time was that he did almost destroy a group of people and force them into not even being able to think because they couldn't read anything. And I'll take my answer off the air.
Yeah, Philip Short, we hear it all the time. All the Chinese writers, intellectuals, musicians that come through the connection are all, in a way, running from the Cultural Revolution. The musician, the violinist Isaac Stern, who made a marvelous movie in what, the late 70s, early 80s perhaps, From Mao to Mozart, it was really a tour of the music schools and the young talent of China at that time by one of the, you know, maybe the most famous violinists in the world. He said not one of those musicians, and he stays in touch with them, lives in China today. They all ran to the West.
Yes.
And they were running from Mao.
No, they were running after Mao because when Mao was there, they couldn't run. The fact that, you know, he wouldn't let them out. You couldn't get out of China at that time. It was only after he died and a new, more open leadership came in that people got the possibility of going out. And they did go out in huge numbers for very understandable reasons, because there were possibilities in the West that they didn't have in China. But what really is interesting is that now some of those people are beginning to go back. I mean, I have friends who've been in Tokyo, in New York or in Europe for maybe 10, 15 years, in some cases more, and who are now going back to visit and beginning to talk and in some cases actually going back, because China has got to a point now where they can do the things they want in China, and they couldn't before, but they are, that is beginning to become possible.
1-800-423-8255 makes the Mao connection with Philip Short. Li Shi is in Hampton, Virginia.
Yes. Hello, gentlemen. And
welcome.
Thank you very much to take my call. And hello to Mr. Short. And I find your commentary is very illuminating. And I want to share one observation with you, and then I'll ask my questions. One question. I'm from mainland China. I mean, about 20 years ago, and I was the generation of Cultural Revolution. I can say that, to my observation, the reason Chinese people say that Mao is great is in the sense that he's a great emperor. I mean, the things he did was a great magnitude, either way, okay, destruction or, you know, construction, whichever way you say it. And with such a, I mean, romanticism, everything is based on ideology. And that's why, during the chaotic time, he could succeed in wiping out everyone else and trying to build something. But when he actually sat down to do the building, nothing succeed. And that's my observation. And the other thing I think we haven't, you gentlemen haven't touched it, is that what is the greatest harm Mao has done to China? To my experience or my observation is that he has destroyed the value system of the society, Chinese society.
Mm.
Why there is nothing in place of it. And that is going to come back to harm this nation for a long, long time. And we are seeing it. I'm just giving one example. Despite all the great economic success in recent years in China, there's one thing not too many people pay attention to, is the ruining of the educational system.
Mm.
In recent years, the illiterate rate among the age group, young age group, is actually growing. And even government admit it. And just think about that implication. And that goes back to, you know, what Mao did to China.
This is a deep subject, Li Shi, and I just wonder, how do we begin? This was a man who institutionalized re-education.
Re-education,
came to be known as brainwashing, exactly. But what is the net of that huge change in moral education?
What is I didn't get lost of your sentence.
Well, I mean, Mao had a comprehensive program of training, re-education, propaganda.
Yes.
Called brainwashing.
Yes.
What is the net of it in the China of the 21st century?
What is the net of it?
Yeah, what...
The net result.
The net result is that people become stupefied, so to speak. I mean, we know what is the effect of the brainwash, And that, the other thing I can say of this phenomenon is that the mainland Chinese people's attitude towards Taiwan, that's something to do with this. They always see it as, you know, well, this is because of the, you know, imperialism of intervention from United States, blah, 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 blah. Well, to how true that is. But that already ingrained in their mentality.
But I'm interested in the legacy of the Mao's value system.
It is. I couldn't hear you. I'm sorry.
Mao's value system and its legacy in the life of millions and millions of Chinese people today. What is it?
Well, I couldn't summarize that. What is it? But you see, I don't know what is it. I don't have that theory. I mean, myself.
Let's ask Philip Short.
Yes.
Philip Short, what is the net moral value impact of Mao's re-education?
Well, Li Xi's brought up a whole load of different questions. The moral legacy of Mao is essentially one of destruction. I agree with most of what he said. Mao couldn't build this whole period when people couldn't read in the Cultural Revolution, that and they couldn't talk. It was stultification. Absolute stultification. And Chinese now are extremely concerned with this business of values. You know, what are our values? What is our identity? And the government's answer has been to really rely on two things. The present Chinese government relies on, firstly, economic success. And it says, well, you know, we are thriving, we're prospering. And secondly, nationalism, which relates to what Mr. Li was saying about Taiwan. I don't think they're going to go and invade Taiwan. I think that's a saber they rattle from time to time. But nationalism is certainly one of the vectors on which it's part of the glue, if you like, that they use to keep the Chinese people together. But China needs more than that. Any country needs more than just nationalism. You do need a set of values. And I think what happened was that Mao destroyed in part and suppressed in large part the traditional values of the Chinese. And as I was saying earlier, you know, I think in some senses that has not been a bad thing, because those traditional ways of codes of behavior were very restrictive and they did stop the country developing. But he didn't destroy traditional Chinese values altogether. And if you scratch a little bit deeper in the Chinese psyche, they're still there. The ideas of propriety, the Confucian ideas, propriety, reciprocity. If a thing comes to me, then it's not proper that I don't give a thing in return, which is the basis of a lot of Chinese corruption today. These values are still there. The extended family is still there. Family support. Brothers do support brothers and cousins, and that is still very important, much more so than it is in any Western country, and so on. It's there. It's been suppressed, but it is still there, and I think it will redevelop. It will regrow. Just one last thing on this. When I was in Beijing last summer, there is now a private school that has an elite private school that's been created, which is actually teaching a Confucian curriculum, which I find quite extraordinary. But there are people who are willing to teach it, and parents who are willing to send their children to learn the old Confucian ideas again.
Philip Short, stand by. Well, let's listen to a few more callers. 1-800-423-TALK. Bob is on the line.
Hi.
I wanted to
make a point real quick about the Western tendencies in analysis of Chinese history, particularly recently, and particularly then in with respect to what Mr. Short said about Mao and the Cultural Revolution. And that is that, you know, Westerners seem to look at China and say, gee, these terrible things happened and it must have been Mao's fault. And there's a lot less interest, and I think undeservedly so, in looking at what was going on in China and what were the problems that needed to be solved. You know, at the end of, in the mid-30s through the end of the 40s, China was in total chaos. And the Chinese Revolution, in some sense, was almost necessary to reunify China and preserve it as a political and cultural entity. Then just looking at the Cultural Revolution, What were the things that Mao was trying to do? He saw that the party, which of course had been the vanguard of the whole revolution, was turning itself into a Russian Communist Party and was becoming thoroughly corrupt, and reintroducing a sort of fascist capitalism in the country. And the peasants, which made up 90% of the population, were being screwed again. And, you know, he had this sort of interesting problem of, when your power base becomes corrupt, how do you attack it when you don't have a power base? And I think that's really one of the very interesting formative threads of the Cultural Revolution, and actually has echoes in recent American political history as well.
Can he shed responsibility onto the party, Philip Short?
No, Bob, I have to say I don't agree with you on that one. There was a problem with the party, sure, but, you know, it wasn't that serious a problem. And you talk about capitalism in the countryside. Well, if one desperately poor family having one tiny little plot on which they can grow a couple of cabbages is capitalism, okay, yeah, there was a problem with that. But the peasants were far, far happier being able to have their little private plots and grow something for themselves than they were when it was all taken away and an ideological drive was made to stop them growing anything of their own in the Cultural Revolution. I really don't think that was the peasants getting screwed. That was the peasants getting a little bit of freedom, which they were devoutly grateful for, and which Mao promptly disliked. He saw it as capitalism and said, you can't have that. No, I think the Cultural Revolution was ideological. It was the working out of Mao's ideas, an attempt to perpetuate them.
1-800-423-8255, the Mao Connection with Philip Short. John is on the line.
Hi.
Hi, John. Welcome.
Hi. I'd just like to put in a good word for Taiwan. When I was there in the early 90s, it was really amazing to see the dynamism, the democracy, every time there'd be an election, the trucks coming around, democratic slogans. And I just think that it's sort of disingenuous in a way to assume that the way China is now, it could only have gotten there through Mao's methodology. I mean, if you look at what Chiang Kai-shek built in Taiwan, and then his son, Jiang Zemin, sort of really helped to turn the country towards democracy, and that was only in a single generation. So I don't think we should lose sight of what Taiwan has built for itself as a model for democracy in Asia.
Philip Short?
Christopher, I'd like to come in on that. Yes. Taiwan, you have to remember two things. First of all, population, 17 million people, as against 1,200 million. Secondly, Taiwan was colonized by Japan from 1894 up to the Second World War. They put in a lot of educational and industrial infrastructure. Then, after 1949, this very small island had a great deal of American aid. You really are comparing apples and oranges. I think Taiwanese democracy is great. It is one of the really hopeful things happening in Asia now, along with democracy in Korea, South Korea. But to say, well, because it worked in Taiwan, it could work in a country, 100 times bigger with almost 100 times the population, 50 times the population, is not true. Chiang Kai-shek in the late 40s was, his regime was as venal, corrupt, crumbling, decaying, rotten as a regime can get. And it's really only because of American help, and then because of his son, Cheng Jingguo, and the present president, Lee Teng-hui. It's in very recent times that Taiwan has become a democracy. It's in the last 10 years or so. You go back further, and you find really quite nasty things going on in Taiwan. So don't knock the Taiwan success story, but please don't say it could have happened in China, because it's just on a totally different scale.
Philip Short, are biographers in China having it the same material and coming to conclusions anything like yours?
Well, a lot of the material is being published in China, and my book has been translated into Chinese, and one of the big Beijing publishing houses wants to publish it if they can get it through the censorship this year. So we shall see. That will be another little measure of whether they're really liberalizing.
Philip Short, thank you enormously for joining us on The Connection. Philip Short's new big book is called Mao, A Life. Thank you, Philip Short. and to the callers and listeners. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston. Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation. PRI, Public Radio International. From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Wordsworth Books in Harvard Square, hosting author E.L. Doctorow, who will be reading from his new book, City of God, Thursday, March 2nd at 5:30 p.m. at the Brattle Theater.